Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Klosky coming at you live from my house, and it's our weekly book club class. Welcome aboard to Gulf Meadows Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies book club class. We're continuing our study of the Return to Zion, Addresses on Religious Zionism and American Orthodoxy, Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik. Today's class is Monday, and it's July 17 of 23, and it's recognition of the present and vision for the future. This is a talk that he gave in June of 1945. It's a rather long one. We're going to try to get halfway through it today. Okay, I'm on page 53 if you've got the book. And so let's begin. In truth, I waited a long time before I finally agreed to deliver this address this evening. My indecision and ambivalence were due simply to my feeling distressed. Maimonides' rules in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, chapter 7, halacha 4, prophecy descends only upon the happy. Well, I must confess, I don't understand. This is Plosker speaking. I don't understand how God could have been conversing with Jonah, the prophet, toward the end of the book. How is prophecy descending only upon the happy? Jonah is suicidal. I never quite understood that. But all events, Rabbi Soloveitchik continues, an orator is, excuse the comparison, like the prophet of yore, here he's referring to Elisha, who requested, get me a musician, 2 Kings chapter 3. Kachli minagin, is what he says. He must hear the beautiful music of the future in order for prophecy to rest upon him. When good spirits are lacking and despairing doubts, it is difficult to be inspired and to speak to Jews. Musician of our history today. Where is the music of the present? In Treblinka? Majdanek? In the British politics regarding the land of Israel? In the world's indifference to our tragedy? When I finally agreed to speak, I did not submit a topic. Yesterday morning, I read in the newspaper that I would talk about Torah. I am proud that the word Torah is associated with a lecture of mine. This is not due to any merit of my own, but to that of my father's house, which developed the art of Talmudic analytic critique, much as Immanuel Kant developed the art of philosophical critique. In the yeshivas, they refer to the methodology of my grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, as Shita Sahavana, the methodology of understanding. Reb Chaim Brisker was the first to observe that the Torah is expounded not in 70 ways, but with one method. There is one truth, not two. A question is either challenging or no question at all. There is only one answer. If a question has two answers, neither of them is useful. I do not know how the Torah could be taught on American soil if it were still connected with ingenious argumentation and casuistry. A modern head would be unable to tolerate it. Amazing things that he's saying over here, by the way. He's making the point that his grandfather, Chaim Brisker, initiated the Brisker Derech of learning Talmud, which is a little bit different than back in the day. Now, remember that the Vilna Gaon fiercely fought against Pilpul, which had been the order of the day when they came to Talmud study for basically centuries in Poland. There was Pilpul, which was very, very creative, and some people consider it sophistry. He uses the English term, another English term, casuistry, which is like, you know, false argumentation and hiding the ball and picky details and all kinds of stuff that go into maybe an argument, but doesn't lead to any truth in the argument. It's all semi-fantasy and it's super creative, but it doesn't have much legs. The Vilna Gaon fought against that mightily. And the truth be told, if you go into a yeshiva today anywhere in the world, into a Lithuanian-style yeshiva, the question of the day is always going to be, what's pshat? What's pashut pshat? What is the pshat? What is the Gemara saying? What is the pshat? What is the simple explanation of what's going on over here? He says that. So what are they arguing about? And how do we get some clarity on that? And what's pshat in Rashi? Why is he weighing in? What's he adding to it? It's always about getting to the fundamentals. That was the Vilna Gaon's approach. We have to be very grateful to him for that. So that lasted from Volozhin's creation in the early 1800s through to today, Pasha Pshat has been the lodestar for typical yeshiva guys. But then along came Chaim Brisker in the late 1800s, and he formulates a slightly different approach, the Brisker Derech of learning, which is you read the Gemara and then you go straight to the Rambam. You go straight to the Yad HaChazaka, to the Code of Jewish Law, which the Rambam wrote, and you see what he writes regarding the Talmudical topic you're studying. And the Rambam effectively becomes a commentary upon the Talmud, much like Rashi and Tosfos are. And that alone is a very, very ingenious way of looking at the Rambam, that he is commenting upon the Talmud by virtue of what he writes. He says, the halacha is like this, the halacha is like that. So he's distilling from the argumentation of the Talmud. He distills the black and white law, and that, in the minds of the Briskers, that's serving as the Rambam's commentary. He says, okay, the Gemara says this and that and the other thing. I'm going to write, here's what the halacha actually is. Okay, very good. What then do you do? So Chaim Brisker, in his great genius, came up with all kinds of ways to figure that out. He says, one thing over here, one thing over there. So as often as not, it would come down to what we call tzvei dinim, two laws. And the reason why he writes X, Y, Z in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah and X and A, B, C over there in Hilchos Peiros is because there are actually two laws afoot. One law applies to this and one law to that, and that explains why he wrote what he wrote. No longer any contradiction. There are actually two laws going on over here. And this was all extremely Chiddush-oriented because nobody had the mind of Chaim Brisker. Nobody saw this. He completely originated a whole new approach to Talmud study. I don't know if the Vilna Gaon anticipated this, having known everything himself, but if he knew the Brisker Derech, he kind of kept it to himself 100 years earlier and didn't share it with the world. He was just interested in Pasha Pshat, in his great depth of understanding. He said, we have to always go for the Pshat. Obviously, he was also a tremendous, tremendous Darshan, tremendous Mekubal, but his approach was, what's the proper Girsa? He was always trying to fix up, mistakes in the text of the Talmud and the Midrash. And he was fabulously successful in that. So the Vilna Gaon was unusual. And I don't want to dwell on him just now. I want to dwell for a moment more on Chaim Brisker. He absolutely initiated the whole new Brisker Derech of learning. And what I find amazing about that is what the Netziv's son writes about Chaim Soloveitchik. And it's in the Hamizrachi magazine of this month. Rameir Bar Ilan, who is the youngest son of the Netziv in the second marriage. Now, the Netziv was born in 1816, and he passed in 1893, and he led the Volozhin Yeshiva, for nearly 40 years. Okay, so he was a co-Rosh Yeshiva with Chaim Brisker. They were both Rosh Yeshivas of the world-famous Volozhin Yeshiva. And Rameir Bar Ilan gives an appreciation of his father, and also Chaim Brisker. Let me read to you a little bit what the magazine writes. Students traveled from all over the world to study at Volozhin Yeshiva. After it closed down, they migrated to the one place where the Volozhin Yeshiva still in some way lived on. So Chaim Soloveitchik in Brisk. Chaim Brisker was born in 1853, and he passed in 1918. He was younger than the Netziv by close to 30, 40 years. He was there younger, but they were both co-Rosh Yeshiva. He writes, a scion of the Soloveitchik rabbinic dynasty, Chaim Brisker developed the famous Brisker method, a highly analytical method of Talmud study, focusing on precise definitions and categorizations of halacha, which would shape the way much of the Torah world studies the Talmud. During the yeshiva's final years in Volozhin, Chaim Shir attracted the greatest students of the era. In Rabbi Bar Ilan's words, quote, he was the Rav of the generation and a guide for future generations. And unlike the Netziv, he was a staunch opponent of Zionism. He thought it was a movement that sought to destroy traditional Judaism and replace it with nationalism. Still in all, as a Jew, he loved the land of Israel, and he had great support. He greatly supported the old yeshiva that was centered in Yerushalayim. And so, in honor of the Netziv's 130th Yortzeit, which falls on the 28th of Av, and Rav Chaim Brisker's 150-yard site, falling on the 21st of Av, we are honored to translate, says the magazine, several passages from Rav Meir Bar Ilan's memoir, From Volozhin to Yerushalayim, in which he describes his father's and Rav Chaim's opposing views of the nascent Zionist movement. Okay, remember, Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan was originally called Meir Berlin, and he was so into Israel, he renamed himself Bar Ilan, and there's a university name for him right now, Meir Bar Ilan University, obviously. And also, my brother learned in Yeshiva at Or Yerushalayim, which was in Moshav Bet Meir. Moshav Bet Meir is named for Meir Bar Ilan. Okay. Now, here's what he writes about Rav Chaim Volozhin. Here's what Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan writes about Rav Chaim Brisker. Rav Chaim Brisker, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. By nature, Rav Chaim was the kind of person who was burdened with spiritual suffering. He was always afraid of the day of judgment, of tomorrow. Every thought about illness and death depressed him. Every bad tiding about someone's death had a terrible impact upon him. Even more so, he was gripped with unusual dread over the future of his neshama, of his soul, afraid that it would come to spiritual destruction. He was afraid of any new movement in Judaism, fearful that any step off the beaten path was likely to cause people to stray from Judaism. He lived and conducted himself without considering all of the aspects of the issue, because the one thing that was certain in his eyes was this: to grasp onto the old without any change whatsoever. In Zionism, he saw not only the desire to build up the land, but also the cause of new theories and new problems in Jewish life and thought. This alone was enough to make Zionism frighten him, just as he was afraid of all modern learning, newspapers and books, and anything that contained something new and was not accepted and passed down through the generations. Amazing. Amazing to write that, because he then went and created a whole new movement. He himself was the initiator of a whole new movement, if I don't understand, the Holy Talmud. I'm serious. The Brisker method was his own creation. It's caught on among, you know, some of the best and brightest, where they go off to learn in Brisk, or they go to YU, and there's a full contingent of rabbis over there who are Brisker Talmidim, from the Rav himself, from Rabbi Soloveitchik himself. Fine. But you have to appreciate that in those days, when he first promulgated this new movement, there were a lot of critics. One of them said, this is just pharmaceuticals. He said, this man is like he's a pharmacist. You know, one great rabbi was critical of Chaim Brisker. He said, it's just mixing drugs together. I mean, it's just like, it's a whole foreign way of looking at the Talmud. And it had its critics. To this day, you have people who are not learning in Brisk. Now, why aren't they? There are plenty of guys in the mirror who could get into Brisk. I mean, I realize the Brisk is only so big, so you can't have 10,000 guys in Brisk. But there are plenty of people who preferred, back in the day, instead of going to Rav Yeshua, to Rav David, they went to Rav Nachum, from the Mir Yeshiva, the famous Rav Nachum Pritzavitz, and they learned Pashup Shat. They learned how to understand a Rashi. What does Rashi say? You're not going to necessarily get that in Brisk. And Brisk is going to be, how do you reconcile, you know, the Rambam here and the Rambam there? You know, and I learned that up with a chavrusa in Baltimore. And after a while, I was going like, okay, like, you know, at the end of the day, the Rambam being in a state of contradiction does not keep me up at night. Maybe it should, but I don't lose sleep over it. But for Chaim, you know, his mind was constantly, you know, how do you reconcile the Rambam? Because it can't be that the Rambam could possibly contradict himself, even though it's certainly possible that could be the case. But not for Rav Chaim. At all events, some people just prefer to learn classical Talmud in a classical way, and they go to the Mir. And in the Mir, you learn from Rav Nachum Pritzavitz how to understand a Rashi. Pashut Rashi, you were learning in 5th grade, 6th grade, 7th grade. Now you're an adult. Now you're going to actually learn how Rashi operates. You go to Chappelle's, or Bikolinski was a student of Nachum Pritzavitz. And he, to this day, teaches how to understand Rashi like that. It's a third-level shiur in Chappelle's. So that's the classic approach to Talmud study. How amazing is it for a person like Rav Meir Bar Ilan, who observed Rav Chaim Brisker up close and knew that he was opposed to anything new, to to think that Reb Chaim Brisker himself revolutionized the very study of the Holy Talmud is itself unbelievable. Because if you're so afraid of anything new, how do you then understand that he created something very, very new? And that in Limud HaTorah of all things. You would think that you should never, theoretically, you know, you should never go outside the bounds of what you're familiar with and just learn Shas and Poskim within the normal realm. But no, not for Reb Chaim. Came up with a whole new approach. And yet he was definitely afraid of new things. It really is amazing. Good. So I wanted to share that with you. And also, very Soloveitchik himself, he writes, Reb Chaim was the first to observe that the Torah is expounded not in 70 ways, but with one method. Now, how do you understand that? If we do have a notion of Shivim Panim LaTorah, that the Torah can be learned in 70 ways, so how do you come along and say, no, there's no such thing really as 70 ways, only one way. It's my way. Now, how does that work? There is one truth, not two. Now, what does even that mean? That there's not one truth, but there's no such thing as two truths, but there's only one truth. Everybody knows when you study the Talmud, Rabbi Kiva says this, Rabbi Lezer says that, Rebbe says this, Abaye says that, Rabbi Meir says this, the Chacham say that. Everybody knows that the Ramban and Rashi don't agree on Allah Torah. He always quotes Rashi, then he asks him a China, how can you say that? What's going on? So Rashi has his defenders, but the Ramban is very often a critic. Rashi and Tosfos don't get along with each other on the same page of Talmud. We know that. Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yosef Eibschitz were not friends. I mean, they were like mortal enemies when they were fighting each other in the 1700s. Rambam had his critics. The Ramachal had his critics. Hillel versus Shammai. Everybody knows that when you're learning the Talmud, you say, well, one is right and one is wrong, correct? Answer, no. No, they're both correct. Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. These and those are the words of the living God. It's just that we have to paskin one way because we need some sort of coherence to the halacha so we can all observe the halacha worldwide. So we need to have a psak din. But everybody knows that what Rabbi said is also correct, and what Rabbi said is you're obviously correct. And Hillel and Shammai, they're both correct, but you have to paskin a shana, so you're pastor. But elu ve'elu, divrei Elokim chayim. So how do we understand Rabbi Yosef Shaber saying over here that in his grandfather's mind, there is one truth and not two truths. What I'm trying to convey to you, the point that in Torah study, open up a Mishnah, open up a Gemara, the whole thing is one big argument between various rabbis. So how do you understand that? A question is either challenging or it's no question at all. Well, I'll grant you that one. There's only one answer, really. There's only one answer? There are many answers put forth by the Talmud all the time. Answer number one comes up, knock it down. And then answer number two, three, and four. We recently saw that in Moed Katan. They're all good, effective answers. What do you mean there's only one answer? There's not more than one answer. If a question has two answers, neither one of them is useful. I don't know about that. I don't know about that because they both could be answering the question. How could it be there's only one answer? And now here's where, you know, Rabbi Yosef Shaber is of the opinion that his grandfather, Reb Chaim, saved Talmud study for America, without even realizing it. Because he was walking, Chaim was in a scientific era, obviously, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, in the very thick of the scientific era. And his approach, according to Rabbi Yosef Shaber, his approach was like of a scientific nature. And so therefore, this kind of approach could be okay for the American mind. An American kid on American soil would never be able to learn Talmud without learning it Brisker derech, but learning it Brisker style. I don't understand that at all. I mean, that I got to reject that whole notion. Because what can I say? I studied the Talmud, he studied the Talmud, they studied the Talmud. Everybody's studying the Talmud. In Lakeway, you think every single person is studying it. I mean, a lot of them went to Brisk. That's true. A lot didn't. A lot did and a lot didn't. How are you learning Talmud up until you go to Brisk when you're in Philadelphia for Beis Medrash and then high school in Beis Medrash? You spent 8 years studying the Talmud. So did you study the Talmud during the 8 years? I think so. And then you go to Brisk and you learn a whole new approach to the Gemara. Does that mean that everything you did before was worthless? And that the 80% of the world that never got into Brisk and doesn't know how to do it, you mean that all that Torah study is worthless? The whole thing is ridiculous. You think to say that Americans living on American soil can't study the Talmud and be satisfied with the question and the answer that we get? All the time we're satisfied. I don't have to come out to Reb Chaim Brisker, Tvei Dinim and the Rambam to live my life. I mean, I don't get that. I just don't understand that. I don't know how the Torah could be taught in American soil. It's taught every single day like that in American soil. Whether you go to Cincinnati, or you go to Cleveland, Tells, or you go to, like I said, Philly, or you go to West Bloomfield, Denver, the Chavetz Chaim approach, people studying Talmud all day long. Are they doing it Brisker style? Not necessarily. So Torah is growing in America, but he feels it couldn't be taught in American soil, that the modern head would be unable to tolerate it without Reb Chaim's approach. I'm going to have to very respectfully disagree with that, but what can I say? Anyway, we continue on. Rabbi Yoshua Soloveitchik continues. It's a beautiful essay. Hopefully we'll get through it. It seems to me that Jewish politics, too, must develop a shitas ha'avana, a political critique. This would teach the politicians to assess and relate to problems differently and not to make so many mistakes. However, I wish to surprise you tonight. Remember, he's speaking in June 1945, right after the ending of the Second World War. However, I wish to surprise you tonight, perhaps pleasantly, perhaps not. I want to speak a bit specifically about the current political state of affairs. True, I will have recourse to Torah, since I see the wider Jewish world through a Torah telescope, and I see the narrower Jewish world through a Torah microscope. But I must touch upon the political situation. All of our thoughts revolve around it. Remember, it's right after the Second World War. 6 million dead. 6 million Jewish people gone. 3 years away from the founding of the State of Israel. And over the next 2 years, it's going to be Layahidim over there in Israel. It's going to be craziness. Because people who refugeed out of Europe and escaped out of Europe, they're going to run to Israel. They're going to get guns into Israel. They're going to try to fight the British, to kick the British out and declare a state. It's going to be unbelievable what's going to go on over there over the next 2 years. Excuse me, the British are going to come down hard on the Jewish terrorists, they'll call them, and the Jews are going to fight back, and they're going to be in prison, and the famous Tzadik Yerushalayim, Rabbi Levine, is going to go visit them. It's just going to be, they're going to be blowing up buildings where the British are. It's absolute chaos in Israel from 1945 to 1947. And early in 40, and then there was a vote in 47, and the declaration of the State of Israel in May 1948. So for 2 years, it was insanity. Jews fighting British, Jews fighting Arabs, Arabs fighting the Jews. It was absolute chaos. Let's see what he says about, he's going to be, it's a beautiful, beautiful vort. I've read 10 pages in, I'm loving it. So let's let him lay it out. I admit that I am no politician. In Amos, it says, I am not a prophet, and I'm not a prophet's son. Amos chapter 7, verse 14. And so I will speak about these problems as an ignoramus. When the ignoramuses, upon whom ritual impurity was decreed, would come on pilgrimage to the holy city of Yerushalayim, the city of the aristocracy, they would be told, be careful not to touch the table. Be careful lest you touch the table and the menorah. He's quoting, of course, Gemara Chagiga, which we saw when we're learning it in Gulf Manor Synagogue School of Jewish Studies in Shorter Talmud class. You'll see that Gemara Chagiga 26a and b. And I can promise you, he says, that similarly, I will make sure not to defile the lofty politics of the American Zionist Emergency Council. However, one may, of course, examine them. And I'm obviously allowed to say whether the table and the menorah please me or not. As a rule, it would not be a bad thing if we were to think about politics in light of the Torah. Among the 8 vestments worn by the Kohen Gadol were the holy tzitz and the choshen hamishpat. The holy diadem, the tzitz, is described in the Torah as follows. Quote, you shall make a frontlet of pure gold and engrave on it the seal inscription, Kadosh Lashem, holy to God. It shall be on Aaron's forehead, that Aaron may take away any sin arising from the holy things that the Israelites consecrate from any of their sacred donations. That is Exodus 28, verses 36 and 38. The tzitz symbolized the head of the Kohen Gadol, of the Jewish nation's leader, which had absorbed the oral Torah, the established laws, Torah thought and philosophy, and the Torah Weltanschauung, a German word meaning outlook, Hashkafat Olam in Hebrew, Weltanschauung, a world outlook. On a lot of questions, this head bearing the tzitz ruled either ritually pure or impure, exempt or responsible, permitted or prohibited. The law follows Rabbi Akiva or Rabbi Eliezer. This head formulated novel insight about slaughter that is not fit to render meat permitted. Sichulin 80. Testimony about a full matter, not half a matter. See Baba Vastra. The principle of extend and raise the partition. See Sukkah. And animal blemishes like a perforated gullet and a cut windpipe. See Chulin. This Jewish head was deep in thought, while the hands were soiled with miscarried fetuses and placentas. See Brachos. By contrast, it's a reference to King David, who had studied Torah all night and during the day, he was involved in Shilas. By contrast, the Choshen HaMishpat, which is described as follows, quote, Aaron shall carry the names of the sons of Israel on the breastpiece of decision over his heart before the Almighty at all times. Exodus 28, verse 29. That symbolized political leadership, the Choshen HaMishpat. They would not inquire of the Choshen, hey, potter or mutter, exempt or responsible, but rather they would ask, shall I go to war or not? So it's brought down in Maimonides, Hilchos Klei HaMikdash, chapter 10. That is to say, they would ask of the Choshen HaMishpat what was politically right and what was politically wrong. A political problem is the same as a question about an aguna, a chained wife, or about moving prohibited items on Shabbos. The same leader whose mind knew what was permitted and what was prohibited also carried on his heart the full weight of all 12 Jewish tribes. He suffered and rejoiced with them, and he guided their destiny. See Exodus 28. Thus Aaron shall carry the instrument of decision for the Israelites. So it was for generations. Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Yoshua, and Rabbi Eliezer were the leaders of the emergency council that negotiated with the authorities. They ruled not only on the laws of divorce, but also on daily political questions. Where to be as inflexible as a cedar, and where to be as soft as a reed. When to give one's life rather than sin, and when to do the opposite. If the mind represents sanctity, then it is the heart that stands for self-sacrifice and political intuition. So you see, from Rabbi Yeshiva Soloveitchik, the same rabbis who paskin daily shilas on Tum and Tahara, Tarovos, whether the chicken is kosher, can also and should be the ones deciding on day-to-day political questions as well. Back in the book, there is a remarkable question in one of the tshuvas, in one of the responsa of the Gaonim, about the rumor we have heard concerning the coming of the Mashiach and regarding an adhesion within the heart. What is your practice? A question about the Messiah and a question about adhesions, pure idleness. But historical Jewry felt that there is indeed a connection between adhesions and the Messiah. Within the last stretch of time, the link between the tzitz and the choshen has been severed. The Kohanim Gedolim who wear the tzitz have withdrawn into the four cubits of the halacha, of the Ketzos HaChoshen and the Netivos HaMishpat. And in many instances, those Kohanim who bear the choshen have no relationship with the holy tzitz, with the seal inscription, Holy to Hashem. The fault lies with them both. Those bearing the tzitz on the head have overlooked the fact that halachos are intimately connected with halichos, with actions. As a result of learning halachos, the student transforms them into halichos, ways of actually acting. And then he inherits Olam Haba, see Gemara 73a. And the new Kohanim, who wear the choshen don't appreciate the full heritage of the generations, the entire Jewish psyche, the whole Jewish worldview. They lack tradition, historical continuity, as well as vision and intuition. It would not hurt if the modern choshen were to be considered from the vantage point of the tzitz. This is, in fact, the ideology of the Mizrahi. I don't believe in the dicta emanating from the modern choshens, no matter whether they are choshens of assimilation or of sectarian zealotry and political wildness. I also highly doubt the choshens and the political intuitions of our leaders of the movement to return to Zion. When the tzitz, meaning on the head, is missing, the choshen, that which is on the heart, must be critically evaluated. And this is the task of the Mizrahi. We Jews have always been at odds with the sages of Greece when assessing different stages in the life of an individual or of a community. The Greek outlook put much stock in times of serenity, in calm, contented periods, in harmonious personalities, in gradual morphological developments, in the entire chain of cause and effect, in the uniform demonstration of human powers and abilities, in the proportional order of antitheses and their neutralization. As a result, this antique worldview could not grasp the problems of evil, of wickedness, of suffering, of despair and resignation, times of spiritual crisis, of historical cataclysms and worldwide upheaval, of destruction and annihilation, of sin and crime, have always negatively affected the Hellenistic spirit, paralyzed its capabilities, and depleted its sources of life. The problems of sin, distress, disaster, destruction, evil, and negative satanic forces in creation were never solved by Greek philosophy, which spoke so much of form and harmony. The Jewish outlook was one of the first to give the world the idea of tshuva, that sin is not something indelible that remains as an eternal stain on a man's soul, but can rather be overcome, or better, used toward living a sublimer, more elevated life. We Jews consider this subjugation in Egypt to be a precondition for the birth of the greatest personality in history, the master of all prophets, Moses. Please remember to mute yourselves, my dear friends. Thanks so much. We Jews consider the subjugation in Egypt to be a precondition for the birth of the greatest personality in history, the master of all prophets, Moshe. And mortar and bricks were a precondition for the setting of the theophany. And that is, of course, a visible manifestation to humanity of God, the great theophany of Sinai, the giving of the Torah. The episode of the golden calf to be the prelude to the 13 attributes of mercy. Or Kazdim, Ur of the Chaldees, to be the force that brought Abraham into the world. And the binding of Isaac, that which brought about the Jewish nation. And Jacob's exile and suffering to be the prerequisite for the birth of the 12 tribes of Jeshurun. We Jews have always maintained that there are no negative powers or unfavorable circumstances that paralyze and deaden all that lives and produces. Rather, everything can be used for a great creative purpose. Everything can be historically transformed into something magnificent and gigantic. Indeed, we have always asserted that the Baal Tshuva stands higher than the Tzaddik, see Gemara Brachos 34b, since he has sunken low, but climbed back up again. Adversity sanctifies man, elevates his spirit. Gemara Brachos 5a, adversity cleanses all of a man's sins. It smooths out his blemishes and implants within him a new soul. Times of crisis are pregnant with the vision of redemption. Tribulation beckons to salvation. Birth pangs and suffering to the Messiah. The phrase Chevle Mashiach, the birth pangs of the Messiah, is in the genitive case, suggesting that birth pangs and the Messiah are connected. A person achieves greatness in crisis. A nation attains vision and a spark of prophecy in a time of distress. We find the master of the universe not only, as the religious thinkers among the nations of the world do, in the splendor, order, and harmony of creation, in the sometimes invisible moral principles and forces that govern the cosmos, but also in tribulation and subjugation, in despair and despondency, in an indifferent, cruel, false world, in a world of power, flattery, and deception. Indeed, in such a world, one needs the master of the universe more than in a beautiful ethical setting. Mima'amakim kirasicha, Hashem. Out of the depths I call you, O God. See Psalm 130. Out of crisis grows a great, magnificent Knesset Yisrael, nation of Israel, reborn and renewed, young and vigorous. There is no evil from which good cannot come, no sin out of which a new ethical principle cannot develop, no falling down without rising back up, and no time of distress in which the countenance of the Messiah cannot be seen. Devarim Rabbah says, Midrash Devarim Rabbah, Israel will only be redeemed on account of suffering, as it is written, when you are in distress, Deuteronomy 4, hence on account of suffering. You shall then return to the Almighty your God, hence on account of tshuva. The renaissance and redemption of the Jewish nation will come about through hardship, adversity, and martyrdom. Not harmony, but discord. Not peace, but struggle. Not pleasure, but deep suffering will pave the way to the Jewish Messiah. This is incredibly important. Because everybody thinks that everything's going to be hunky-dory, hunky, complete-dory. Before Mashiach comes, it's going to be tremendous. Maybe some feel like that, and it's going to be great, and the base mikdash is going to be out from heaven, and already pre-packaged and pre-built and the whole thing, and we shouldn't be going through any of the suffering that we're going through in the land of Israel today and the whole thing. It's not how the world operates. It's how maybe a fantasy operates. It's not how the world that God created operates. It's not how human beings operate. Continuing. However, this is not simply a lesson in the philosophy of suffering or Jewish metaphysics, which has only theoretical work. Expound it and receive reward for doing so, says the Gemara Sanhedrin. Rather, it's also an ethical teaching, a practical Weltanschauung, a political program, and a way of life. Watch these words, friends. Watch this. A person must achieve the level of an aspirant, a world builder, a cholem, a dreamer, and a lochem, a fighter, and always carry within himself the prophecy of redemption of the days to come. See Isaiah chapter 2. Even more so, in times of success, joy, and blessing, he must certainly develop such aspirations, such visions and prophetic reveries, hopes and dreams. And he must strive to realize them in moments of distress and grief, in times of pain and despair, in crisis and in extremis. I love those words. You've got to become, everybody's got to be an aspirant. You have to aspire to the great stuff. You should be a world builder. You've got to be a dreamer. And along with that, a fighter. And must always carry within you the prophecy of redemption of the things to come, the great days to come. Have that always in your mind, always as the lodestar. Why am I doing all this? Because the days will come, and they will be better days. So if you have to think like that, even in tough times, how much more should you think of these great dreams when things are successful and joyous and full of blessing? You have certainly to develop those aspirations, those visions and prophetic reveries, he says. And they'll carry you through those moments of distress and grief. We continue. Pasuk in Exodus 24, verse 10. This is when some of the leaders of Israel had a vision of God, and they continued to eat, and yet they had this incredible vision of Hashem. See Parshas Mishpatim. And they saw the God of Israel. Under his feet there was like the likeness of a pavement of sapphire, like the very sky for purity. Yet he did not raise his hand against the leaders of the Israelites. They beheld God, and they ate and drank. An amazing pasuk, amazing to psukim. Exodus 24, verses 10 and 11. Unfortunately, there are people, leaders of the Israelites, aristocrats, civilized men, political authorities, who don't understand this maxim. One must see the God of Israel both in times when, quote, under his feet there was the likeness of a pavement of sapphire, which, quote, is here is Rashi, which was before God during the subjugation in Egypt to remind God of the anguish of Israel, who was subjugated by being forced to manufacture bricks. You've got to think, you've got to see the God of Israel both in times of melancholy, he writes, and pain, in subjugation and oppression. You've got to see God then. It's the same God, he lives forever. So you have to be able to see God in times of melancholy and pain, in subjugation and oppression, when one feels so orphaned and alone, when under the feet of the Jewish God one discerns bricks and clay, a pavement of sapphire. And you also have to be able to see God in times of jubilation and salvation, when one views him through a lens like the very sky for purity, and a Shekhinah shines in all its splendor. Once they were redeemed, there was before God radiance and joy, says Rashi, song, dance, and light. Our job is to see God at both times, both in the good times and in the bad times. He cannot only be the God during the good. That's not the God of Israel. It's not the God of creation. Jewish people have suffered for so much of their history. Always, always under the guiding eye of the Almighty, we cannot possibly understand why so much terrible destruction took place. End of the first temple, end of the second temple, Crusades, Spanish Inquisition, Khmelnytsky, pogroms, blood libels, and the Holocaust. Who can understand all that? Who could possibly understand all that? That's 1,000 years of bloodshed, a solid 1,000 years, from the Crusades till now. Amazing. The same God watches over Klal Yisrael. The Jewish aristocrats do not grasp this moment, the duty of the hour, and they're preoccupied with immaterial concerns, with egotistical trifles. They ate and drank. They enjoy the present, and they disregard eternity. And just as we Torah Jews know that the halacha embodies the entirety of Jewish ideology with its full metaphysical theosophical range, so do we know that the halacha itself rules in practice that adversity, despair, and loneliness are sometimes more important and have more historical value than moments of luster and political power. The Jews sanctify the land of Israel twice. The first time in the days of Joshua, and the second in the days of Ezra. When one compares the two eras from a secular historical standpoint, from a political economic perspective, the second entry into the land, Ezra's sanctification, is no more than a pale reflection, a weak echo of a great and glorious epoch, such that the comparison itself arouses gloom. You must hear this to believe it. In the days of Joshua, the nation was young, filled with an aggressive militant spirit, pounced on the land of Israel like a youthful desert lion, defeating 31 kings, claiming one victory after another. Nature itself helped the young Jewish people forge its destiny. Stand still, O sun, at Gibeon, O moon in the valley of Ayalon. See Joshua 10. They conquered the land in 7 years and divided among the tribes in 7 years. See Gemara Zevachim 118b. They were proud and youthful, pugnacious and courageous, filled with all the romanticism of a nation stepping out onto the historical stage and enjoying the respect, the awe, and admiration of its neighbors. Dread of you has fallen upon us, and all the inhabitants of the land are quaking before you. Joshua chapter 2. In the days of Ezra, the 10 tribes were entirely absent, having been exiled to Chala and Chabor, or in the words of the Jewish Agadah, beyond the Sambatyon River. See the Jerusalem Talmud, Sanhedrin 10. A segment of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin wanted no part in the return to Zion, the second temple, or the redemption. They were happy sitting by their flesh pots in Babylon, Persia, and Media. Cyrus, Darius, and Ahasuerus, and the other kings altered their edicts 7 times a day, each new declaration repealing the previous one. One moment immigration was allowed. The next, they issued a white paper halting entry. Here, Rabbi Soloveitchik is clearly talking about the British. One minute, the Balfour Declaration. The next minute, a white paper saying no more Jewish emigration into Palestine. Even with someone positioned as close to the monarchy as Esther, the land of Israel could not be mentioned. Quote, at the wine feast, the king asked Esther, what is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be fulfilled. See Esther 5. Half the kingdom, but not the whole kingdom. And not something that would serve as a barrier to the kingdom. And what's that? The building of the temple. The Gemara Megillah 15b. She was allowed to talk about Beis HaMikdash. Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs, the Ammonites and the Ashdodites. That's Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 1. Who are those people? Well, not friends of the Jews. And he continues, Samaritans, enemies, informers, hateful broadsides, defamation, and behind-the-scenes plots, fear of violent excesses and pogroms. Quote, the basket carriers were burdened, doing work with one hand while the other held a weapon, that we may use the night to stand guard and the day to work. See Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 11 and 16. With one hand, we have to extract water from the Negev of the land of Israel. With the other, we have to protect ourselves from Arab hooligans. And the internal situation? Economic hardship and spiritual impoverishment, intermarriage and ignorance, lack of language and tradition. And above all, we have become a mockery. That's Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 36. We have become objects of shame and derision. Nevertheless, Maimonides, the great Jewish teacher, the pillar of the halakha, comes along and rules that what? That the first sanctification was in effect in its own time, but not for all time. Whereas the second sanctification, by Ezra, that is in effect forever, both in its own time and for all time. Siochus Trumas, chapter 1. You hear? Joshua's sanctification via capture and military victory, undertaken in an unbridled, gushing, enterprising spirit of conquest, when proud prophets, warriors, elders, students of our teacher Moshe, and heroic legions seized the land of Israel, was no more than a temporary phenomenon. Nebuchadnezzar abrogated it. But Ezra's sanctification, which came about through daily, small-scale, unheroic, painstaking work, through disappointments and despair, intercession with and requests from the authorities, insults and humiliation, that remains forever. Neither Titus nor Hadrian, neither Islam nor the Crusades, neither Turkey nor even the British colonial office can undo it. Maimonides explains this halakhic paradox using the same philosophical idea. Why do I maintain that the first sanctification was not in effect for all time with respect to the rest of the land of Israel, vis-a-vis the sabbatical year, tithes, and so on? The reason is that the requirements to observe the sabbatical year and the tithes depended on the land being conquered by the people. So that once it was taken away from them, their conquest was negated. See Hilchos Beis HaBechira, chapter 6. Joshua's sanctification was not the result of hardship, but of historical success during glorious moments of Jewish history, none of which is forever. Ezra's sanctification, by contrast, came about through occupation, settling the land through the word of God, through adversity, martyrdom, spiritual pain and despair, mockery and derision. Ezra's sanctification emerged from crisis, tribulation, and subjugation. Redemption born of suffering, the Messiah born following birth pangs, are eternal. Sanctification for all time. My friends, it goes on. There are 20 pages of this beautiful essay. We could stop right here because you must stop somewhere. So we'll stop over here on page 61. And we'll be able to pick it up, God willing, next week at 1 o'clock. We'll continue. How beautiful are the words we read in today's Haftarah out of the book of Zechariah. Please join me, therefore, next week at book club class, Monday afternoon, 1 o'clock. We'll continue with Joseph E. Soloveitchik on recognition of the present and vision for the future, delivered in June 1945. Thank you so much for joining me. Zai Gazin, have a great day and a great week. Please join us tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday as we continue our study of 2 Kings, chapter 19. We're in the very thick of it. And friends, frankly, we're almost at the very end of the book. We are at the end of the book. You might as well join now, because whenever you're going to learn 2 Kings ever again, this might be your only chance to do it on a regular basis. So come join us every Tuesday night, Tanakh Tuesdays at 7:30 for 2 Kings chapter 19. Thanks so much. Have a great day, everybody. And we'll see you tomorrow night at 7:30. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.